House Labor and Commerce, House Labor and Commerce Committee, please come to order. I'd like to note Representative Ringstad, Representative Ewling, and Representative Copeland present. First bill that I, it's 8/19, March the 7th. First bill I'd like to deal with is House Bill 545. And I note the prime sponsor was here.
Right.
And if the sponsor would like to come to the table and testimony. 545 is a bill that proposes action on in the Alaska statute that would mandate that workers in the food service industry be given a 30-minute rest or meal period during work shifts that last 8 hours or more. And with that, I'd like to recognize Representative Locker and hear her testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Barbara Locker, and I represent District 16, CA, Massey Borough. I'd like to thank this committee for hearing this bill in such a timely manner. It does not appear to be that important a bill, because the first thing people say when they read it is, you mean this isn't already law or regulation? And I can tell you that it was brought to my attention by some food service workers in my community that they were not allowed a break in an 8-hour shift, even to eat or have a cup of coffee, and I offered to research it for them because I felt sure there must be state law that would require it, and at that time found out that there are no current laws requiring employers of food service workers to provide a half-hour break for their employees during each shift. There's also no federal or state laws requiring an employer to provide employees with rest or meal periods during a work shift. However, private employment agreements and collective bargaining contracts frequently require rest and meal periods, and the Alaska Department of Labor will enforce those private agreements. It would seem that food service workers who do not have these employment agreements or collective bargaining contracts could then be required to work through a shift without having any break time. And in our research, we found that in fact was so. This seems to be one segment of our workforce that historically this has been denied. I would like to say that probably the second question that follows the first one, that isn't there already a law, is why don't you do it for everyone if there isn't such a law? And I have no problem with doing it for everyone. And in fact, we ordered a committee substitute for you, and we were hoping that it would be here, that would just require it for all workers. However, my concern is with the food service workers, because they seem to be the one segment that is denied this one very necessary privilege, in my judgment, and really isn't even a privilege. I noticed on the material that came to us from the Department of Labor, and I don't want to steal their thunder, they very clearly identify this as one group that does seem to not have it. Are there any questions?
What other workers, I mean, who in your mind might be have similar situations that we might cover? Do you have anybody specific?
Mr. Chairman, if in fact you do decide to cover all workers, and I think that's probably a good idea, in my research, I have not identified another group of workers. This is the only group that apparently is regularly denied an opportunity for a break.
Any questions? Representative,
thank you, Mr. Chairman. Barb, in going through this, did you review for other specific groups to see if they were on statute, or did you just go across and see if there's any statute regarding it?
There is none.
There is none at all.
There is none. So if, in fact, you do decide to pass a committee substitute, and I see that my aide now has it and he's making copies for you, that would solve the problem for everyone.
Okay, in the way you've drafted this, saying that you get at least one meal or rest period of no less than 30 minutes
during each shift of 8 hours. Did you look at all to kind of coincide that with, like, a lot of our unions and different groups have contracts? Is this roughly the similar language that they put in?
No, it is not. Many unions have contracts that require within the first 5 hours that you appear on the job that you must be given a break. Everyone has, some unions have contracts that if you don't get the break, you get paid for a half an hour. I mean, everyone has a different contract. And I wasn't trying to address those because I think that those serve that purpose. I have not had anyone come to me and complain that they are not getting a break, except food service workers. And so, you know, I didn't really reach out into other groups of people that are covered by agreements or contracts. I figured that their problems are solved. However, the committee substitute would solve that problem. I can tell you what some other states have done. And I can say that Hawaii requires employers to provide breaks to employees who are minors, but does not require breaks for adult workers. And of course, anyone researching would say up until now that Alaska does not require it for anyone, and that is true. California requires employers to provide a meal period to workers in some fields, but food service workers are not on that list. And they mentioned that Washington's administrative code requires employers to allow employees to take a meal break of at least 30 minutes, no less than 2 hours, and no more than 5 hours from the beginning of a shift. And in addition, employees must receive a paid 10-minute break for each 4 hours of work. Oregon requires it, and that was about as far as we went. We just, you know, frankly, we identified a problem in this state, and we tried to address it. Now, if it's a problem for many employees, or even in your judgment, it could be a problem, then the committee substitutes the proper bill.
Representative Ringstead.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. The question, or the point you made about whether or not it's a paid 30-minute break, where we're saying shall provide the worker with at least one meal or rest period, is it your intent to have it be a paid break?
Absolutely not. It's not my intent to interfere in the employee-employer relationship. It is just my intent to ensure that someone provides a break for that person to eat or drink, and it's a very short one. And I suspect that if I were the employer, you know, in order to make my place what I would consider a better place to work, I may pay for that half an hour or I may not. And I certainly wouldn't want a state law that would tell me which it was I had to do.
So what you're saying then, if you know, somebody decided that they wanted to work the whole shift without a meal, they couldn't work just 7.5 hours and demand 8 hours pay. They would have to actually take the break.
If those were the work conditions, yes, they would have to take the break. I suspect that it would be like most of us. I mean, most people appear at work and leave 9 hours after they first get there, and an hour is considered to be their lunch hour. And this is worked out. I mean, I don't know, personally, I don't know of anyone who works at any job other than in a restaurant or is a bartender or cook that doesn't have some time provided for them on a regular basis. Now, emergencies happen, things can happen, but on a regular basis, food workers work 8-hour shifts without a break.
I have one follow-up, then I'll have you. You stated earlier that there was a law or something that it required for in collective bargaining agreements or something, 5 hours for work you had to have a rest period or a meal. Are you sure of that accuracy? I mean, there's a lot of construction jobs, say, that work 12-hour days. I think they just have one meal break.
I must not have done a very good job because I didn't say that.
Oh.
Okay, what I said is that there are some states that require that that break be within the first 5 hours not less than in the first two. That's not my intent.
Representative Ringstead.
In this, I think, correct me, I'll make sure I'm right. Your intent is to say that the employer will provide it, not necessarily that it's required that the employee take it or use it. But if the employee wants it, the employer has to provide it.
I would suggest that this bill would force employers to plan for people to take a half an hour break. If, in fact, something came up that they couldn't, they would have to make some sort of an arrangement with that employee.
Representative Healy?
Does that mean that when you say provide, then that's going to be a paid 30 minutes?
No, it does not. It says provide a break period. It does not say a paid break period. However, the commissioner of the Department of Labor is here, and they would be the people who would enforce this, and so it's very important that he tell us how they would interpret this, and you're quite right, Representative Ewing. If that's in question, that is not my intent.
Yeah, I think because just by putting the terminology provide each employee, I think that that would be interpreted as paid 30 minutes, even though it is not said paid. That's going to be a cost to the employer.
Well, I'm an employer of 12 people, and I would not interpret it that way. But should the Department of Labor, then we'd be in trouble.
I'm sure they will.
Any more questions of the witness? Thank you. Commissioner, are there anyone else that signed up to testify on this bill that could sign to Commissioner?
Chairman, Jim Robinson, the Commissioner of Labor, members. Representative Reed said, I wouldn't read that would be a paid 30-minute period.
Okay.
Provided that you would not have to pay for it. But I honestly have very little to add to that. Mm-hmm. I think that we look at it more from a safety aspect, is that, especially in the food service, back in the kitchens, you take an eight-hour shift when you have the stoves and the hot water and the knives and all of those types of things, that we just think that they should be provided a break from the safety point of view. A little bit on the contracts. Most contracts that I've dealt with provide that you have to have a lunch period within a five-hour period.
Yeah.
Either that or you have to pay the guy for a half-hour break, and then you also have to give him a half-hour on top of that to eat his lunch. On the project agreements where you work 10, 12, 14-hour shifts, we negotiate that you'll have a meal period halfway between those hours, whatever the time is, and it's an unpaid job. It is unpaid.
They are, so the contract, union contracts, or most negotiated contracts, it's a five-hour period, as you said, but actually, as law, does the law, labor laws, doesn't address that?
It does not address it. If a contractor or employer violated that portion, mm-hmm. and the guy put a claim in, then we could go in and get the monies for those.
Representative Ringstead.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Commissioner, is there any group of employees that maybe because of their job structure shouldn't be put in this category?
Mr. Chairman, I think in all fairness that that most of the employers in the state of Alaska assume the responsibility and in fact give a meal period or a break. I think the Canberra's may be one that would work long periods of time without a break because of fish coming in or the product. I know I've talked to some of them that have worked the line 10 or 12 hours reading, but they're just going and relieving themselves and not having a break. So I'm really not sure what that would do to that industry. I'm not sure that answers. I honestly don't think I could identify a class of employees out there that other than food service.
Representative Ewing?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Is there anything in the U.S. labor law that indicates a 30-minute break period that would be similar to this?
I don't think so.
Nothing.
As far as enforcing, I suppose we could say like cab drivers and truck drivers, maybe the road line haulers and stuff, maybe they might get caught up in listening to Willie or something and go beyond this period. A lot of times they're out on the road or they're going to go between two points and they have a particular place they want to stop and eat. Do you think this would be enforced, could enforce it to cover situations like that, I mean, that would require them to stop, say if they were out in Timbuktu and no place to eat, but the 5-hour period or the 6-hour period or a time, you know, a time that we might determine. I know it doesn't address, I mean, I'm thinking about if we try to address other workers besides the food service workers.
Mr. Chairman, it honestly doesn't say that it has to be in the middle of the shift so that it could be, you know, 7.5 hours, you got to give the guy the half hour. I think on the road haulers, most of them is either owner-operator, either that or I would think that maybe the rest of them is covered by contract.
Sure. There is a federal law called Hog Law, which it limits the number of hours you can either drive or run a train or fly a plane without a rest period because of the safety factor. And since we're by ICP to the extent that it's enforced.
Any more questions?
Thank you, Chairman. Mr. Chairman?
Yes.
Right.
Representative Ringstaff?
Mr. Maynard, as a member of the AG's office, this isn't exactly your field, but would you interpret if we say an employer shall provide each employee that is a non-paid for?
Generally, in particular, with the testimony that's been here today, I'm going to say that
yes,
Commissioner
Bob Maynard of AG's office, yeah.
And if the commissioner gives regulation that effect in the way he interprets it, will make it very clear. If you're still concerned about it, I would suggest you put a letter of intent.
I'm not sure you can go through that sort of. I just wanted to see if we had an AG's person here, I might as well ask.
Mr. Chairman, even though we've had testimony from the Commissioner of Labor, I think that there's still, when it's stated in there, I think that someone could contest it. I think that an employer shall provide could be interpreted as something that would be paid. I still think that that could be a real problem, and I would think that maybe this would have to be redrafted.
If it's all right with the sponsor, maybe perhaps we can address that, and I'll bring this back up. Clarify that, absolutely. Clarified.
Mr. Chairman, I don't wish to argue with Representative Ewing, but we have someone from the Attorney General's office. We have the Commissioner of Labor. We have this committee's testimony on tape that it is not our intent. Further, they have requested that if you wish to insure it, that you have a letter of intent. I just hate to have the bill held up. I'm afraid this bill will not make it through the system if it's not.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I don't necessarily want to hold the bill up, but I don't think a letter of intent is going to improve the bill. I don't think a letter of intent is going to really be the answer. If there's something that has to be changed in the bill, it needs to be changed in the bill.
What, do you have some wording or how?
Well, I don't know. I just had a chance to look at it this morning. What's the next committee referral? Maybe it could be.
There isn't one.
Mr. Chairman, I don't have a problem. To me, saying shall provide, it leaves the option as whether they provide a paid or an unpaid. It doesn't say how you provide it, just says you provide it. And I think that if a contract is reached to say that it's provided to be paid for, and that's between the employer and the employee. If it's an unpaid for one, again, that's between the employer and the employee. Yeah, to me, the way I read it, all it says is that the half hour is provided one way or the other.
Representative Furness?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. To is it your intent in this that it'll be paid, that period of time be paid by the employee, or does it matter?
Absolutely not. Representative Furness will relate to him. It is absolutely not. And I guess that's the other thing about getting real specific. Should an employer wish to make his place a better place to work by paying someone, or wish to pay them rather than in under an emergency, you're not going to give him that option. I want to stay out of the employer-employee relationship. Right. Just set down a guideline of what it is the legislature requires for Alaska.
Is the intent then, rather than the actual meal itself, is a 30-minute more of the focal of the bill?
Correct.
And that's it. That's
that is correct. Just a break. And it could be, like Commissioner said, send them home in 7.5 hours.
Right.
And that's why I didn't approach it from the up to 5-hour period either. I realize that in a lot of small businesses, it may be a problem. But they will provide it now.
Mr. Chairman, if I may follow, I would assume reading this, we're talking primarily of full-time persons as opposed to part-time persons. Sounds pretty clear then, Mr. Chairman.
Yes.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Representative Gibbons.
What about if we were to put an employer shall allow each employee? We put allow in there versus provide. Would that make a difference, Representative Locke?
I would suggest that if you use the word allow, it may be possible that an employee would have to make an assertive effort to get that half an hour. And then you may have a problem with this relationship that when we're talking about. When you say the employer will provide, you're very specific. He will provide it. But if I were a waitress in a restaurant and there were seven of us and I was the only one that requested a half an hour break to eat, I don't think I would last very long in that restaurant. That's my question when you use the word allow. Now, there may be something else. I guess I just haven't heard. I know that you're concerned, Representative Ewing, and I think that that I will do more homework. But all the professionals have insisted that...
I just think we have to be really careful when we get into the labor law question. Because it can be interpreted unless it's very, very specific. And at least
okay.
That's my dealings. Now, I don't have a problem if we can, if it needs to be looked at on the floor, I guess we can look at it on the floor.
I would like just to hold this bill till tomorrow.
Okay.
And we get that one area and we will deal with it tomorrow.
Thank you.
Thank you. The next bill we have up, House Bill 630. And we have, 680, I'm sorry, 630. I'd like to have my staff, basically this, I have one of my staff do a quick analogy of the bill, and Merrill, would you like to, it's a bill, I think that he can explain it, and then we'll get into some testimony. State your name for the record.
Merrill Sikorski, S-I-K-O-R-S-K-I, Representative John Condry's office. What this bill basically will do is give the state authority to apply to the EPA for transfer of authority to control and regulate injection wells that are associated with oil and natural gas production. Before you, I included in your packets what the governor had to say when he transmitted this bill. For approval in the House for introduction to the Rules Committee. And Mr. Chatterton is here, who is with the Oil and Gas Commission, and we also have an expert witness here that AOGA has sent down on our request to answer any questions about the specifics and technicalities of the bill. It's basically, the bill has been designed to be a simple piece of legislation, and there is one problem with the original bill. Some verbiage problem, and we have drafted a CS, and I'll let Mr. Chatterton address the need for that CS.
Well, thank you.
Mr. Chairman, do we have a CS?
I've got it right here.
Mr. Chatterton?
Thank you, sir.
Your copies of the
question. Mr. Chairman, members of the House Labor and Commerce Committee, I am Chat Chatterton, and I'm chairman of the Alaska Oil and Gas Conservation Commission. And Mr. Chairman, as you know, the committee by statute is established as an independent state agency with quasi-judicial powers. By statute, the agency is also charged with the administration of Title 31, Chapter 5, which House Bill 680 deals with, and is commonly referred to as the Alaska Oil and Gas Conservation Act. Mr. Chairman, I appreciate this opportunity to appear before you and offer testimony on the bill. The bill adds a new subsection, AS 3105030, which is sets forth the powers and duties of the commission. Mr. Chairman, the purpose of the bill is to provide, I'm being redundant to Merle, I'm sorry and I apologize, but I'll stay with the written text here, will provide legislative approval, if passed, for the commission to seek enforcement primacy from the Environmental Protection Agency And if granted by the Environmental Protection Agency, the verbiage of the bill would provide legislative approval for the commission to enforce within Alaska the Safe Drinking Water Act of 1974 as it applies to what are known as Class II wells, underground injection wells, as defined by the Act. And they are as Merrill indicated to you, they are underground injection wells, injection of any type of fluid dealing involving oil and gas production operations. I want to emphasize, Mr. Chairman, that while the bill authorizes the commission to apply, there is no guarantee that the Environmental Protection Agency will approve the right of the commission in this case to undertake primacy for Class II wells. House Bill 680, Mr. Chairman, as it now is before you, most certainly provides the statutory language that permits the agency to move forward. However, as now worded, it appears to me to leave some dangling statutory participles. That is, some conflicts with existing statutory language, which could or may cause a problem. I am aware, Mr. Chairman, that the staff has a draft of a proposed Labor and Commerce Committee substitute for House Bill 680, and I understand that the substitute, in fact, I have just been given a copy and have looked it over, and the committee substitute proposal really takes care of all my concerns that I had with the original bill. And further, Mr. Chairman, why the fiscal note that was provided with the original bill, the committee substitute, has no impact on it. It would be the same fiscal bill. Mr. Chairman, that concludes my direct testimony. I know there are others present wishing to testify, but Mr. Chairman, upon conclusion of their testimony, I respectfully request yours and this committee's for an opportunity to appear again before you to offer three specific amendments which are unrelated to underground injection control, but I believe considered desirable for the purpose of updating and clarifying Title 31, Chapter 5. And it goes back to my old feeling, it's well within the subject matter, well within the same title, and well within the same chapter, and it's a good horse, and I'd like to throw a little saddle on it.
We will try. Would you, for Mr. Chatterton, again, just for you, the record, who you represent? I don't know if you've stated.
The Alaska Oil and Gas Conservation Commission.
Thank you. Representative Furness, and then Representative Ringstead.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I have three questions to Mr. Chatterton. In fact, Representative Chatterton. Has there been any discussion to date with EPA towards the transfer of this responsibility to your knowledge?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Furness, there has been ongoing, off and on, discussion with Region 10 EPA people, even to my knowledge, even before I was a member of the commission. Starting in about 1980, there has been a great ongoing lobbying by Region 10 EPA for the state to accept primacy and under what is known as Section 1425 of the bill, which was an amendment added to the original 1974 bill in 1980.
So at least they are aware that this is an intent or a desirable conclusion on behalf of the state of Alaska.
They are aware of that, Mr. Chairman, Representative Furness. They are certainly aware of this. I believe that they have been advised that the governor did introduce a bill.
Okay. My second question is because of the apparent high water table throughout the state of Alaska, as I understand it, in some of the wells, you may inject salt water into the well for whatever reason. Does this pose any type of a danger to the environment, to your knowledge?
Okay. Mr. Chairman, Representative Furness, we have, by statute And by regulation, in Title 31, Chapter 5, and regulations we have promulgated from there, what we believe fully protects the freshwater aquifers in the state of Alaska. And the unfortunate thing is that the the Safe Water Drinking Act of 1974 just has a few more little quirks to it, sir, that than what we do as far as reporting, as far as permitting, so forth and so on. But I would submit, Mr. Chairman, Representative Furness, that we in oil and gas production operations, we will assure the people of Alaska that the fresh waters are being protected today and have been since the commission was in existence.
One last question, Mr. Chairman. In the bill, Representative Chatterton, line, this is the
you're referring to
line 18. This was a new section added, and it's probably self-explanatory, but it states here that notwithstanding of this section, claims of confidentiality will be denied for information disclosed to the commission under Chapter 31. Under what condition would this be pertinent? Are there confidentialities and as far as injections or maybe location of wells? And how does this come about?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Furness, this is a subsection being added to 3105.035, which is the confidential report section of Chapter 5, Title 31. In effect, we are required to keep all well information.
No, excuse me, we is
the we commission.
Commission.
By law, by statute, by this statute, must keep all information on a well, with the exception of depth. I'll list you off a few. Depth, regular production, production data, and that's about it, for a period of 24 months after they have filed what we call the completion report on the well. It really becomes a 25 months confidentiality period following the completion or abandonment of a well. We hold all information on that well, without that exception I mentioned, confidential for that period, unless the operator, the person who drilled the well, willingly says you may release the data. Now, the requirements of EPA for us to accept primacy, one of the requirements is monthly reporting on all injection wells. Present statute, in my opinion, says that we could not release it to EPA. So therefore, the enabling, this is one of the boxes I felt, Representative Burns, of you again.
Okay. The importance of this, as you well know, once this hits the floor, somebody's going to ask that question. My notes would be prepared me to deal with that.
Thank you, sir. Okay.
Representative Ringstaff.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. First, I'm going to touch on that paragraph a little bit. Notwithstanding C of this section, claims of confidentiality will be denied for information disclosed to the commission that is required. Somehow this doesn't sound like it's reading. It reads funny. What are we saying in that paragraph?
I think, Mr. Chairman, Representative Ringstaff, what I think it is saying, and I have no pride of authorship because I didn't author it, but what I think it's saying is that the information disclosed to the commission, well, here you have 3105.030H right above it, okay. Now, notwithstanding C of this section, which is the existing language of 30 of that section, which says I shall keep all information for 25 months, in effect, of this section, claims of confidentiality, will is a backward way to put it, I think, will be denied for information disclosed to the commission under the primacy portion of the statute that is required to be disclosed under 42, that's the village, not village, I'm sorry, the Safe Drinking Water Act of 1974.
So we're saying that if I come to you asking for information, then you're going to deny the request.
That's not what it says, but that's the way I first read it too, sir.
Well, that's why I'm saying, is the wording proper on this?
If you're just the opposite.
Yeah, if you carefully read it, I think it is proper, it's okay.
Claims will be denied at company jail.
So that it says, if I come in and ask for that information, you can give it to me?
That's exactly right. It is not going to be held confidential from you, the public, or EPA.
Isn't this kind of a funny way of saying that?
Sir, Chairman, Representative Grinstad, you're asking me an unfair question.
Maybe that was a rhetorical
question. Maybe it's unfunny
question.
At this point.
It's almost, you know, your classic legalese. Okay, Mr. Chairman, if I may, my other question, in paragraph H there, we're dealing with the federal statutes, we're discussing federal statutes. Safe Drinking Water Act, 1974, as amended, etc. Which in the Safe Drinking Water Act of 74, are we just addressing a specific portion of that section? I'm not totally familiar with that act. Are we addressing to a specific portion that affects drilling, or are we addressing the whole act or a wider area? Can you address kind of the scope of that a little bit?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Ringstad, I'm on very thin ice here, but I'll do my best. I'm not an expert in this by any matter of means at this point in time. But I believe that the reference that you have there is that portion of the Safe Drinking Water Act 1974 that deals with what are called Class II, Roman numeral II, underground injection wells, which is what we are seeking primacy for. And I have not read the
policy. Okay, the reason I'm questioning is we're having trouble with our drinking water quality things with EPA in several areas, and I'm just wondering if we're touching on one of them here, whereas we're getting the same safe drinking water standards for our pulp mills and our plaza miners and everybody else in the state. I'm just wondering how wide we're hitting with this reference.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Ringstad, I'm sorry, I cannot answer that. I have an idea, Representative Ringstad, that maybe someone else that will be testifying on this bill may be able to help on that. I can't, I'm sorry.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Any more questions for Mr. Cassidy? Do you have any more comments at this time?
Mr. Chairman, yes, I'm sorry, I did have one question. With this in there, you indicated that the information that you are permitted to disclose would be the depth of the well and any regular production data that they chose to have disclosed. Does this section pose a problem to the companies? Are there strict areas of confidentiality that they may not want to have disclosed within that 24-month period of time or 25-month period of time?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Furness, I guess I may suggest that we better see what the person testifying for the industry says. I cannot believe in my own mind that if a well is converted from a producing well to an underground fluid injection well, or if it is drilled for the purpose of injecting fluids, that anybody would have any reason to ever want to keep any information on that well confidential. You're so far beyond the period of competitiveness that I can't understand. But I'm only one voice.
Sure.
are the, have the feds been doing this elsewhere, similar, allowing this?
Mr. Chairman, there are of the approximately 30 oil-producing states, I believe that about 75% of those states have already or are in the process of applying for the primary enforcement of safety for Class 2 wells. The EPA, to my knowledge, has promulgated, put it this way, they had proposed some regulations for the state of Alaska, which I believe they have are in effect operating under a court order, which I am not familiar with, that they have to implement those regulations and start to enforce them in the state of Alaska within the very reasonably near future, sometime in 1984.
Would you interpret Class 2 wells just for the committee, please?
I shall interpret Class 2 wells as I have read, as my understanding of what the Act itself says, and that is all under, all injection, all, put it this way, any well injecting any kind of fluid underground that is involved with the operation of producing crude oil or natural gas. It's involved with the oil field operation. If it was for a chemical plant, it would not, out in the middle, in say the middle of Anchorage, it would not be a Class 2 well. It would be, I don't know what, but they've got about four classes of wells.
Follow up. If the feds are making this transfer, this is the earlier question, possibly considering this transfer, are they any programs to help the state fund it? I mean, are there going to be federal funds available, or do you feel that that's possible?
There may be. I believe that federal funds have in the past been offered. Whether they're still available, Mr. Chairman, I do not know. As I say, I am not an expert. If you people pass this bill, maybe I'll have to become one.
Okay, thank you. Are there any more questions, Mr. Chadwick?
No, thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, sir.
Mr. Chairman, again, if with your kindness, I would like to return.
Absolutely.
Thank you, sir.
At this time, I'd like to get ask Mr. Yeslin to come forward and identify himself for the record. Spell his last name, maybe. And offer testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm Dave Yesland, Yesland. I'm the senior staff environmental engineer with Shell Western E&P Incorporated. I'm representing the Alaska Oil and Gas Association this morning, and I will comment on the proposed committee substitute for House Bill 680. Our association supports the intent of, without state preemption of the federal program, there will be a redundant state and federal program with nothing but duplicated record keeping and administrative delay as a result. Our association prefers that the permitting process for injection wells related to oil and gas operations be controlled by the state. The regulation of oil and gas operations by the Alaska Oil and Gas Conservation Commission is an example of regulatory control based on well-established knowledge of the regulated activity. Therefore, we believe the Alaska Oil and Gas Conservation Commission is the appropriate administrator of regulations that bear on the technical elements of oil and gas operations. And the commission should be the sole administrator of Class 2 wells in this state. The federal program, as proposed, would reduce the production rate of secondary recovery projects, water floods, by requiring the current injection pressure be reduced. The EPA's basis for lower pressures is no more than a rule of thumb which they acknowledge may be changed on a case-by-case review. But until the review is completed, pressure would have to be reduced to comply with the regulations. This reduction would not only reduce current production rates, but even if only temporary, it would reduce the ultimate total production of the formation, causing revenue losses to both the state and the producer. It is therefore a matter of mutual urgency. If the proposed federal rules are promulgated in the absence of state intent and ability to assume the program, there will be a loss with no measure of compensation. We urge the state to assume primacy in the regulation of Class II injection wells, and we believe this bill contains specific statutory language that will serve this purpose. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. Questions, Mr. Chairman? Representative Burnett.
Yes, to Mr. Yeslin. The same question I have asked Representative Chatterton. The section on the bill dealing with confidentiality, to your knowledge, is there anything of concern having to do with the confidentiality of that particular well that by denying those claims will interfere with the operation of the companies?
No, sir, not as we read this. As we interpret it, it would be addressing specifically that information, which on the federal level is required to be produced or to be allowed as public. So that with the reference to 42 U.S.C. 300H-4, that's what we believe we're talking about. Anything else that could possibly be still of a major confidential would not be required to be presented.
Good. One last question, Mr. Chairman. Has Shell been in contact with the EPA concerning the possibility of Alaska taking over the responsibility for the, what is it called, the Safe Drinking Water Act of 74, as in this bill?
We have been acting with the Oil and Gas Association as a member, and the Oil and Gas Association has been in touch discussing with the EPA just what their approach will be, and our understanding is that this is the way to go for everyone's best interest. As a matter of fact, our understanding is that the EPA would prefer states to have their own program.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I think that rings that. Then
thank
you, Mr.
Chairman.
Copeland.
Another question that I posed to Mr. Chatterton on the federal statute references. Are you familiar with those?
Somewhat.
Can you address how wide a scope we're dealing with in that Safe Drinking Water Act?
It is limited. It is specifically addressing the limits that have been derived from the Safe Drinking Water Act that apply specifically to wells that will be injecting the product of waste product of the oil and gas operations activity. The Drinking Water Act is, yes, quite broad. It establishes the quality of and so forth, but within that there are requirements for specific protections to drinking water, and the one that we're talking about is the protection related to our particular activity.
So you're saying 42 U.S.C. 300H-4,
right,
that deals specifically with well injections?
And specifically with Class II well injections.
Class II well injections. Okay, but this next section where you're saying 300F through J, that's a little bit more than H4, is that? Are you familiar with what the differences are there?
No, I'm not. Except that.
Thank you.
Representative Copeland?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I was curious about your comment that fluctuation in the pressure at reinjection, even for a short period, would affect not only the rate of recovery but also the ultimate recovery. I realize it's a technical question. I'm not that technical, but perhaps you could explain some of the problems to the committee why we want to keep control over this question.
I'm sorry, I'm not that technical either to give you the exact physical reason for this, but the geophysical engineers that understand that tell me that in fact if you disturb the equilibrium that has been established during the period of water or fluid injection to the formation that's displacing the oil, that if that pressure relationship is disturbed, reduced, that when you come back, there will be a poorer recovery in the end. You'll end up just leaving a percentage, not maybe a large percentage, but some measurable percentage of the existing oil reserve. But how and why that happens, I'm sorry, I can't answer.
Can you explain or go through that line 19 or line 18 through 21? For clarification, there was some problem of the wording there. The claims of confidentiality will be denied.
Well, as I read that, the denial would be to the operator's claim that he has something confidential and would not be to the person or agency requesting the information. That the commissioner would, say, in a K case, deny me my confidentiality if a representative thinks that had an interest in a piece of data that was covered by the requirements of 300H.4 on the federal level. And so that's the inversion that I put on that. I think that was the intent.
Representative Ringstaff.
This is becoming clearer. So the federal statute says that the information is required to be disclosed. The information that is being required is what you would be saying is confidential.
That's possible. Right? I think it's more along the line that it was information that was traditionally included in a package that had been classified as confidential by the state statute.
Okay. If I run through this, get it right. Okay. You are disclosing information to the commission under paragraph H and claiming that it is confidential, but the federal statute requires it to be disclosed. So therefore, your claim will be denied.
Yeah, I almost got that.
Thank you.
Any other questions?
I'm still following that. This is material was confidential when the well was drilled, but when you stop making it a producing well, it becomes a injection well. Then a portion of that information no longer becomes.
Do you think that they, you know, we're in. Probably Mr. Maynard can explain many billions of dollars worth of lawsuits, and if this would stop, is now the time of some dispute in the future. Do you think that this should be, or maybe perhaps Mr. Maynard would testify later on this, how we could change this that's more understandable?
I feel bad in a way. I'm not a lawyer, an engineer, and this is clear to me, and so I
you maybe should take some pride in
this. You did as well as any lawyer we've got.
Is there any more questions of Mr. Yesman? Thank you, sir.
Thank you.
I'd like to get Mr. Maynard up. And is there anyone else here to testify? Identify yourself, please.
Chairman, thank you. My name is Robert M. Maynard. I'm an Assistant Attorney General with the Department of Law. I don't have anything prepared. I do have some comments, though, based on the questions. With regard to Representative Ringstaedt's concern about the scope of 300H4 specifically says that for purposes of the administrator's approval or disapproval of under a certain section of that portion of any state underground injection control program which relates to, one, the underground injection of brine or other fluids which are brought to the surface in connection with oil or natural gas production, or two, any underground injection for the secondary or tertiary recovery of oil or natural gas. That's all section H4 deals with, and so it does not go beyond that portion of the Safe Water Drinking Act. 300F through J does cover the whole Safe Water Drinking Act, but that is simply a clarifying reference to Safe Water Drinking Act of 1974, just another way of saying it. But it only applies to H4. With regard to the confidentiality section, I would point out first that 442 U.S.C. 300H4 does not, in its own terms, have a requirement of non-confidentiality. It's the regulations and the administrative promulgations under that particular section that do that. So this includes this bringing in the requirements that the federal government would promulgate underneath that particular statute. With regard to clarifying it, the way it is right now might be said to do what the job intended. If you want to make it clearer or think of another wording, you can just say, notwithstanding C of the section, information disclosed to the commission under 30H that is required to be disclosed under 42 U.S. 300H4 will not be held confidential. Just say it that way. Because what you're talking about is simply stuff that comes to the commission that is required to be disclosed under this particular section. And so all you would do is delete claims of confidentiality will be denied for, and at the very end insert will not be held confidential.
And perhaps I would like to, if we're going to change that wording, maybe have a day to really absorb what we're doing here to make certain that that's, but I have Representative Copeland and Representative Ringstead.
I was just wondering if in any way this affects the current question of ARCO's request to EPA for permission to re-inject oil waste. I know this is an ongoing thing. It's probably not in time, but I mean, that kind of question, would that
I
be?
I think it would. Chat would be a better one to understand. My gut feeling is this, if it deals with fluids that are brought to the surface in the connection with oil and natural gas production, trying to re-inject them, yes, they would.
So that would become a state.
Yes.
Thank you. Representative Ringstead.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Mayor, that's, in your language change, that's what kind of, in my thinking here, sitting here was the same thing as taking it will be denied out, but that's toward the end, and maybe that's what you're flowing in through. So that's the same thing you were saying.
Yes.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Any more questions, Mr. Mayor? Anyone else here to testify before Mr. Chatterton comes back? Mr. Chatterton? It's my intention we will hold the bill till we get this one section clarified, maybe for a day or so. Make sure we get it the way acceptable to all.
Mr. Chairman, again for the record, I am Chatterton. Chairman of the Alaska Oil and Gas Conservation Commission, and I appreciate your opportunity that you've extended me to reappear before you in the hopes I might coax you into an amendment to this very fine horse that we have here. There are, I have three specific amendments, Mr. Chairman, and your staff has copies of all of those, and I'll speak to them one at a time and try and answer all questions. He not only has copies of my proposal, but he has a little bit of backup as to why. The first amendment is going to deal with our famous, as we now have, confidentiality section. Oh, excuse me, no it isn't. I'm sorry, I'm ahead of myself. Mr. Chairman, I stand corrected, sit corrected. The Amendment 1 is a proposal to amend 3105-170 by adding a new subsection, and 17, that section, 170, is the definitions section for the for the Chapter 5 of Title 31. Now, Mr. Chairman, you may, unless you wish, you will have attached to this typed copy a stipulation and settlement between the Commission and an oil and gas operator, namely ARCO, that developed very recently, signed by ARCO, signed by the Alaska Department of Law, and signed by the Oil and Gas Conservation Commission. That's as recent as the 29th of February. That stipulation evolved from the fact that we do not have a definition for the term regular production. You will see, you will encounter that term regular production in our famous confidentiality section. And it's that subsection C of 3105035. And in part, I will shall read to you with your permission, Mr. Chairman, the portion of subsection C that needs the definition. It says, well location, depth, status, and production data, and production reports required by the commission to be filed subsequent to the 30-day filing period shall be considered public information and shall not be classified confidential. Again, Mr. Chairman, that is location, depth, status, and production data and production reports that are filed are public information the moment they're filed. It goes on to define, to state what production data is, and I quote, production data as used in this subsection means volume, gravity, and gas oil ratio of all production of oil or gas after the well begins regular production. That term is defined no place. The commission had a split decision on what regular production meant. A member of the oil industry had an opinion that matched one of the splits of the commission. It seems to me that we need to define it. And I'll tell you why. The stipulation, as you will see, deals with production from individual wells of what, in effect, is an oil company at 100% of their dollars took the laboratory out and put it in the field in what we call our Section 35, or we call the Section 35 project. They are spending their own coarse dollars, and they will not be the only ones. Their competitors will want their ops is going to be gored someday too. They're spending their own coarse dollars to experiment, to try and find a way and a mean to economically lift the oil from what we know as the West Sac Sands. They are on the leading edge, if not beyond the leading edge, of types of ways to make Mother Nature yield the vast reserves of crude oil that are in that those West Sac Sands. ARCO felt that we, the commission, said regular production is any time production is sold. That's the way, even though we did not have a unanimous opinion of it, the commission. So we told, in this case ARCO, it's all here, that they would have to file these reports and that those reports would become public information, as statute says. Even though they were in a testing mode, even though permanent production facilities were not in, and they were producing one well a couple of days and then going to another well and using different methods and different techniques, they were totally in a field experiment. They felt that their position would be injured or damaged if that information became public, particularly to their competitors. They felt that there was intrinsic value to this individual well data, and they said they weren't going to do it. They filed an appeal with us to reconsider our opinion. We reconsidered, did not change, which left the aggrieved operator only one course, to go directly to Superior Court. And, Mr. Chairman, that is still an option they have to prevent and forestall this. The commission entered into this stipulation. And I will submit, Mr. Chairman, I would much rather have the legislature define regular production than have the court system and case law define it. That's why the amendment. And I've made a long story, too long maybe.
Representative Furness.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I think you've made it somewhat clear as to what the concern. You were asked to address an issue that you had no legal way in statute or in your present regulation to do so. You've gone through the stipulation and you've come to some conclusion based upon the stipulation. Now you're saying that what the companies actually wanted you to do can be done if we indeed adopt this amendment.
The three commissioners would unanimously feel quite safe, and they were operating within the law with this amendment.
It appears that your indecision before was the fact that there was nothing addressing the particular question.
Precisely.
Now it's being addressed.
That's the
question. Right. It's clear then to me, Mr. Chairman. I propose, if there are no other questions, I would move that we adopt the amendment to be included in FCS.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Excuse me, Mr. Chairman.
Yes.
Representative Chad, you have some information there that you were reading from
on
the other bill.
Oh, yes, I do. It's my copy.
Is that part of
my
statute? Is that part of resolution?
Statute.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Mr. Chairman, would you make sure that a copy that goes into the file?
Yeah.
At least that.
Don't look at all my other notes.
You didn't do an evaluation of the committee, did you?
No.
I could pass that out.
It's not obvious.
I read the newspapers. Mr. Chairman, members of the Labor and Commerce Committee, I'll call your attention, and I'll make this statement that's common to both Amendment Number 2 and Amendment Number 3. There is no problem. Incidentally, none of these three amendments have any fiscal impact whatsoever.
What don't have they?
He'll probably pass them on. I'll make the general statement before we address them. There is no fiscal impact to any of these. Amendment 2 and Amendment Number 3 are for the purpose of anointing what the commission has been doing by direction of a governor for about three or four years. And I'm the type of cat that if you've got the horse, and I don't think any of these are controversial in any way, form or fashion, I would not recommend them if I thought they would slow the course of this bill up one second. But they're just things that would be nice to have in statute, because other producing states have them in their statute. I'll call your attention now to Amendment Number 2, which adds...
Bill, just pass up.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Why don't you give us Number 3 while we're at it?
Okay, please talk for a minute. Five.
Focus is easily on one thing at a time.
Are we ready?
Yeah.
Amendment Number 2 is a suggestion to amend 3105030. We've been there before today. That's the powers and duties section of 3105. By adding a new subsection. And this subsection is that states, in effect, that the commission shall have authority to act as the jurisdictional agency over applications involving natural gas price determination for all wells in Alaska not under federal jurisdiction pursuant to the Natural Gas Policy Act of 1978. And you have attached behind it Federal Energy Regulatory Commission's regulations. The first page is not as important as the second page of that, which you will note, second down stated there is Alaska, the state of Alaska. And it says who the jurisdictional agency is for federal lands, and then it sets out our commission as the jurisdictional agency for other lands than federal. Mr. Chairman, what we have been functioning as this since 1978, even before, while we were still part of the Department of Natural Resources, and what the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission requires us jurisdictional agencies to do is to have submitted to them an application for the determination of a price category. A price category is what I must emphasize, not the price, but the price category. The jurisdiction, and you have about, in effect, roughly about five different price categories. The jurisdictional commission examines the application and makes a finding as whether indeed the well qualifies in under what they call Section 102 or 103 or 107 or 108 of the Natural Gas Policy Act. We make the determination that yes, indeed, or it doesn't, whichever it is. We send that determination to the Federal Energy Regulatory Agency, and they go from there.
Can I ask a question right here? If you could repeat again, Featherton, examine the application and make a determination if it qualifies for the section. What were those sections again?
There's section 102, and there's about five. There's five category codes. If you look. Mr. Chairman, Representative Furness, if you will look on the last, next to the last page of your packet, you will see the section, that's the category, well category, and the section and the category code is right there. And you see the types, the description of those types of wells.
And which ones specifically should we be targeting?
The ones, all of them, but so far to this point in time, the only two types that we have are that we've had any action on are the Section 103, which is a new onshore production well, and we have just processed a Section 102 Category Code 4, which is a new onshore reservoir.
Okay. Perhaps I had another question if I could pose it.
Yeah.
Let's see. Okay. The question had, my original question was who had the responsibility, and I see as per the second page that the oil and gas Conservation Commission has a responsibility. I assume here that you have not been given the responsibility statutorily, and that's what you're proposing to do is to close that gap.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Furness, that's precisely it. I feel uncomfortable without having legislative annotation.
The other question is this Porcupine Drive, where is that?
Beautiful downtown Mountain View, sir.
It is?
Yes, right across from Linden.
Your district.
It's real hard to find,
too. It's not his district.
That's why this is one of the shaky mountains.
It's right across. It's in the old, what used to be a state section in there that was industrialized shortly after the earthquake. In fact, the building that we were in is a state-owned office, is a state office building. It was built maybe right shortly after the earthquake.
Okay.
Right across the street from Linden Transfers, loaded dock.
Oh, yeah.
Any more questions on this amendment? Please continue.
Mr. Chairman, I call your attention to amendment number 3, which is a proposed additional subsection to our powers and duties section of the bill. And this is to anoint us for doing what we have been doing for, well, almost 4 years, well, 3.5 years, regarding our action as a jurisdictional agency again for the Department of the Treasury, U.S. Department of the Treasury, on the Windfall Profits Tax Act. You will note on the second, right after the proposed amendment, you have a letter from Governor Hammond to the then Secretary Blumenthal establishing us as the jurisdictional agency for this purpose. And you have, following that, a good look at just what we are required to do in acting as a jurisdictional agency. We have to determine here whether or not a proposed tertiary recovery operation actually qualifies for escape of the windfall profits tax, or partial escape anyway, and then we, if we so make that determination, we so then advise the Department of Treasury. We have just done that very thing within the last week for a project at a tertiary recovery project at Coteau Bay. And what we have to find are whether or not what is proposed, and then is, you can look to the very last page. To qualify for tertiary enhanced recovery, you have to do one of this laundry list of 10 things, I guess. And they're the determinations we make of an application from an operator to conduct a tertiary recovery project. And again, I would like personally to see it as a statute.
Yes, Mr. Chairman, a two-question. What does the term tertiary mean? What is it?
Okay.
I see the
First, it is any one of those 9 or 10 methods. Okay, let me tell you what it simply means. I think it's a very, I'm going to get on the soapbox. I guess what we say, you make a discovery, I try and put it this way, even though I don't agree with what I'm saying, but it's a common concept and pretty well accepted. You discover an oil reservoir. If you do, and you complete a well or wells or many wells, they generally will naturally flow. When they cease flowing, you will then use mechanical means to agitate them, a pumping unit, pumping rods, or gas lifting, several artificial mechanical means of keeping the well producing. Pretty soon it will quit producing. Now, when it quits producing, that is what is being commonly accepted as primary recovery from the reservoir. When you get to that point, you may want to spend money, capital hard coin of the realm, to water flood the property. Because if your studies and everything else are right, you will get an additional percentage of oil recovered. That is called secondary. And it can be by flooding with water, it can be flooding by cycling with natural gas, or anything. They're basically the old-fashioned secondary recovery. Now, if you become more exotic with miscible floods, surfactant floods, anything like this, any of those things that are listed out there, that laundry list, that is being called tertiary. And the U.S. Congress offered support to encourage the oil companies, a financial boost, to undertake tertiary recovery projects to recover more oil from these reservoirs. We are the jurisdictional agency to make a determination as to whether an application meets these qualifications or not. And then we so advise.
One last question, Mr. Chairman. In the amendment, there is a term, IRC. What does that stand for?
IRC, that's the Internal Revenue Code.
Oh.
That, Mr. Chairman and Representative Furness, that's what you have a page of, right? Right.
RIS and RIC. Well, we're learning a lot this morning.
You know of any technical modifications that might end with quaternary recovery, fourth time around?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Wente.
Copeland. Wente's here.
Oh, and I apologize.
I know that was a very Wente asked question.
Oh, that's great.
Thank you for having us.
That's the best line you've had all morning.
All week.
Okay. I am positive, Mr. Chairman, and maybe I'm being facetious, that once that a governmental jurisdiction were to offer a subsidy to some type of something, we figure out a quaternary method. This is why I detest, Mr. Chairman, the law. It's pretty well set these three things up. Most of them should be being taken care of and done simultaneously from the day the damn pool is discovered and right on down the road. You don't want to wait lockstep 1, 2, 3. The modern way to really, really manage a reservoir is to start all of these primary, secondary, tertiary recovery things from day one.
What I had in mind, actually, for shallower wells, there do seem to be later recovery methods, such as mining, construction of a reservoir, and things like that, permits pumping in a structure not otherwise. And some of the older wells do that, and I know they do it in Europe.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Capone, it's rather interesting. Within the last few days, I read of a group of people that when it comes to mining, actually stripping and mining, if you want, desaturated oil sands, are complaining because they're calling that the quaternary recovery. They are complaining that they have no subsidy, government tax subsidy whatsoever, whereas these tertiary recovery people do. So your question was most timely, and there may be a quaternary recovery.
I keep reading the material. Any more questions?
Just maybe a comment. Do you think, Representative Chatterton, for the sort of the educational benefits of what we've gone through this morning, it's been indeed interesting to me. Mr. Chairman, just a comment to you as Chairman. I personally don't have any problems with the language on lines 18 and 19 concerning the confidentiality. I would think after 2 years of serving in this legislative capacity, we ought to be able to read some simple language. It's somewhat in form as we would normally read in statutes. It's clear, very clear to me. I would recommend that we adopt the three amendments, and as you well see, I've taken some notes and would be prepared to defend the bill on the floor if it so makes it.
It's my intention that I believe these amendments are very worthy amendments, but I don't want to, I think House Bill 680 is a very important piece of legislation to the state, and I don't want to jeopardize it. So I would just, it's my intention to go till tomorrow or something to run through perhaps the other body if we have any problems with any of this. Mm-hmm. And if we do, the, rather than jeopardize 680, we would introduce a separate piece of legislation to mm-hmm. to attend to the amendments. But I just want to make sure that everybody that's concerned is in agreement. So
it would be my wish, Mr. Chairman, also that if we felt that this would slow down the process of 680, why?
I'm not certain that that is true, but I would like to check that out, and we will deal with this in a very timely manner.
Okay.
Thank you,
Mr. Chairman. Thank you, Governor.
Are there anyone else here to testify on 680? Nothing more to come before the committee? We're adjourned.
John, would you see that when this comes up, that we
sure.
have
yeah.
filed to come through?